As it's 1:59 my time, just about the top of the hour, I'd like to introduce our speaker. Wendy Funk, MS, is Vice President and Senior Health Service Research and Project Executive for the Da Vinci Project at Kennel & Associates. Wendy, it's almost 2 o'clock. Can I go ahead and turn things over to you?
Sounds terrific, Rob.
Here you go.
Okay. Hopefully everybody can see my screen.
Not yet.
Okay, perfect. So hello, everybody. As Rob said, my name is Wendy Funk, and I work at Kennel & Associates. Just as a way of background, today I'm going to talk to you about the military healthcare system. I was actually born in the military healthcare system at the hospital at Fort Hood. My father was on active duty for 32 years, and he is a veteran. And I've been working at Kennel & Associates with the military healthcare system for over 20 years. I work in the capacity in research. I also work in privacy, and I do a lot of work in information systems. Today is going to be the first part of a two-part series. I want to talk to you guys today about the military healthcare system and about the benefits that people get when they access the military health system, because that has tremendous implications on the use of the data. Then when I come in next time, I'm going to talk to you about all of the available data elements and some of the strengths and weaknesses of these data elements. And this will be particularly important for the people out here who want to use the Da Vinci system when it becomes available. Da Vinci will have both VA and DOD data in it, and ensuring that you understand the DOD data is really important for the proper use of data for research or other operational activities. So I have some poll questions, which Rob will administer for you. The first question is, are you or have you ever been a DOD beneficiary? By answering this question and the next one I'm going to give you, it's going to give me a better understanding of the level of knowledge that people might have coming into this webinar.
Wendy, approximately 75% of our attendees have voted. Usually levels off around 80%, so I'll give them a few more moments.
Sounds good.
Yeah, it looks like we peaked, and so I'll close the poll and share out the results. And what we have is that 14% answered yes, and a whopping 86% answered no. So
okay,
the slides are back to you.
Yep, terrific. I have one more poll question. Have you ever used military health system data?
And that poll is up, and the answers are streaming in.
Okay.
Things have leveled off, so we'll go ahead and close the poll and share out the results. And this time around, 32% answered yes, they have used MHS data, and 68% answered no, they have not. So back to you, Wendy.
Okay, terrific. That's actually very helpful for me, so I kind of know where to aim in my presentation. Okay. So the agenda for today, I want to talk about what the military health system is, the vision, the mission, and a little bit about the organizational structure, which is in major flux right now. We'll talk about who the eligible population is. We'll talk about, you're going to hear language like the direct care system. People talk about the direct care system a lot, so I want to make sure you understand what that is. There are many, many TRICARE programs, so just like, you know, the VA has VA Choice, the military health system has had an active I think you guys call it fee care, an active purchase care program for many, many years, and there's many different programs, and those programs impact what kinds of data people will have available to them. So what are the TRICARE programs? What are priorities for access to care under TRICARE? And then TRICARE regional offices, and then finally implications for research data. So these are the topics we'll go through. starting with what is the military healthcare system. So the acronym is MHS. I've used it a couple of times, and I'll use MHS from here on out for military healthcare system. So the MHS is a network of military hospitals and clinics. Just like the VA has a lot of hospitals and clinics, and the military healthcare system is supplemented by programs that enable beneficiaries to seek care in the private sector in order to fulfill their healthcare needs. And it's not just in order to fulfill their healthcare needs. There are some statutory access standards, and I'm going to share with you what that law is, and I'm also going to share with you what the priorities are associated with that law. Basically, the military health system is responsible for meeting the needs of the beneficiaries, whether they provide the care themselves or they pay for the care out in the private sector. But they have one other responsibility that no other health system in the United States has, and that is they're responsible for medical readiness of the force. And that really has two components of it. They're responsible for making sure that the doctors and nurses and ancillary support staff are prepared in a time of war to deploy and care for the service members when they're over there at war serving our country. But not just the medical force, they're also responsible for keeping the active duty service members healthy so that the active duty service members are ready to deploy when they need to deploy. So it's a little bit different. Most healthcare systems are worried about things like cost, quality, and access. And those are very important to the military health system, but overriding all of that, the fundamental reason for the existence of the system is to assure medical readiness. So it's always going to be an underlying theme in anything you deal with respect to the MHS. So here are the mission and vision statements of the MHS. And so you can see things like range of military operations and military missions. That type of language is front and center because of that readiness mission, but again, the providing full range of health support for all of the beneficiaries is also critically important to the MHS. I wanted to give you a little snapshot for what a year of the MHS looks like, and so I went into one of the information systems. It's called the MHS Data Repository, or the MDR, and I pulled these numbers. So there's about 9.5 million eligible beneficiaries. This is going to consist of the active duty and the guard and retirees and things like that. I'll go over who these people are at length in a few minutes. But there's 9.4 million of them, so it's a rather large healthcare system. The MHS operates 50 hospitals, a little more than 50 hospitals, and some of these are going to be really small hospitals in really remote areas. For example, we have a hospital in Minot, North Dakota, and that's quite remote. But because the military has people stationed in Minot, they need to make sure that they have access to health care. And so sometimes these really small hospitals will exist in remote places just to support that readiness need that we're talking about. Some of the hospitals are larger. They have graduate medical education programs and things like that. Probably one of the more famous hospitals in America, the Walter Reed Hospital, is a good example of that. There's over 500 medical clinics throughout the world, so not just in the United States, but we have a heavy footprint in Asia and in Europe with hospitals in Japan and Korea and Germany and Italy and places like that. So there's 500 of those. There's about 300 dental clinics. Dental clinics, one thing about dental that's important to know is the military health system and the direct care system only provides dental services for active duty service members. The rest of the dental care is provided through purchase care. Now, when we look at inpatient care, I've put two bullets here, inpatient admissions to military hospitals and inpatient admissions to the private sector. And I think it's important for you to look at the ratio there. So 240,000 admissions in military hospitals, but quite a bit more in the private sector. And that's going to really impact the type of data that's available. So I've worked for the military health system for, you know, as I said, more than 20 years. And the ratio didn't used to look like that. It used to look like it was almost all direct care and very little of the private sector care. But as the population has grown and a lot of Guard and Reserve got activated and they don't live near the hospital, the private sector has also grown. And so you see this ratio here where more care is actually provided in the private sector than it is in the military treatment facilities. So, you know, if you guys would just think about the data that you have available to you from Vinci, when you're doing VA work, you're going to have this robust set of data available to you for what's been captured in VISTA and such. But when you're looking at fee care, you don't have that same level of information. And so that's a very important consideration when you're looking at this military health system data, is to try to, you know, understand how much and how complete the data that you're looking at will be. The pattern that we see for inpatient admissions continues when you look at office visits, where you have more than twice as many office visits in the private sector as you do in military clinics. And again, for prescription drugs, where we have 55 million prescriptions filled in the private sector per year and 35 million filled in the MTFs, or military treatment facilities. So that's kind of a year in the life slide that just gives you an overview of how the system looks in terms of volume. Now, here's the organizational structure today, but if you blink and open your eyes again, it's going to change. Well, not that quickly, but it's going to change pretty quickly. So at the top of the hierarchy, we have DOD, Office of the Secretary of Defense. So that's kind of the equivalent of the VA Secretary. Well, I guess not quite, because the VA is at a different level than DOD, but it's still a very important position. The Secretary of Defense, and then underneath the Secretary of Defense, we have an organization called Health Affairs. And Health Affairs is run by political appointees, and there are a lot of civilian, DOD civilians in there, but it's more the organization that communicates with the Pentagon. Underneath Health Affairs, we have the Defense Health Agency, and that's the operating agency. I'll talk a little bit more about their functions on the next couple of slides. The Defense Health Agency operates only a few military hospitals. They operate Walter Reed. They operate the hospital at Fort Belvoir and some of the small associated clinics and things surrounding there. Those are operated directly by, quote, DOD. Now, underneath DOD, we have the service components. We have the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force. So the Army has a Surgeon General, and that Surgeon General is responsible for all of the Army facilities. So these would be medical treatment facilities that are on or around Army bases. The same thing holds true for the Navy, although one thing that I think is important about the Navy, they're a little bit different than the other two services because they're responsible not just for the Navy, but they're also responsible for the Marines. And another thing that's really different about Navy people is that you often have a lot of Navy people on ships, and that's not true for the other services. They don't tend to live on ships or on their planes or anything like that. And so what's interesting here is that you have three separate command structures, Army, Air Force, and Navy, with three separate headquarters operating, you know, three separate health systems, and then all of those health systems fold into what is called the military health system, or the MHS. So that's today's organizational structure. So just some selected functions. Health Affairs, what they're responsible for doing is funding the services. So they don't give money directly to any facility, any medical clinic. What they do is they give the Army Surgeon General, the Air Force Surgeon General, and the Navy Surgeon General a large pot of money. Those are called operations and maintenance dollars, and then those dollars are used to operate the facilities. Health Affairs also makes policies regarding the military healthcare system. So, for example, we get a National Defense Authorization Act, an NDAA, that talks about all the new things that Congress wants the military health system to do. And so Health Affairs takes the National Defense Authorization Act every year and initiates work groups to help come up with the policies and the implementing guidance to get the programs or changes that Congress wants made done. Health Affairs also advises the Secretary of Defense on force health and other related issues. So, you know, very recently I've spent a lot of time working on the transgender issue. You've probably seen a lot of that in the paper, how it's kind of gone back and forth what was going to happen with transgender service members, whether they'd be able to join and things like that. And so what Health Affairs does is they do things like look at, okay, well, how many transgender service members are out there? What are we spending on them? What kind of services are they providing? You know, how does this impact readiness? All of these kinds of things get looked at by Health Affairs, and then Health Affairs goes forward to the Pentagon to kind of talk to the decision makers and, you know, the general officers and admirals and things like that to come up with policies and implementing guidance. Congress also, or the Health Affairs also works with Congress, so when somebody wants to change a benefit or something like that, there are plenty of people up on the Hill working on policy analysis and helping Congress to understand some of the implications of potential decisions they'd like to make. They're also responsible for submitting budgets and things like that. So that's Health Affairs. Underneath Health Affairs, as I said, is the Defense Health Agency. We call them DHA. And for people who've worked with the military health system before, this used to be called TMA, or the TRICARE Management Activity, but it changed names 3 or 4 years ago. TMA is responsible for executing policies that Health Affairs provides. They're also responsible for coordinating with the services. So a lot of these work groups that that are put together to make policy and things like that, the DHA will work very heavily on getting service buy-in and, you know, concurrence, or at least if there's non-concurrence, making sure things are heard. The DHA also administers the private sector care programs, so they're responsible for paying all the claims, for modifying contracts, for, you know, implementing things like when ICD-10 diagnosis and procedures came out, it would be DHA who would get that done in the purchase care system or the private sector care system. They administer central information management and information technology, and I know you've heard a lot about that lately. Right now, the thing that they're working very heavily on is the MHS Genesis implementation. This is the new electronic health record that the military health system has just purchased, and the VA has also purchased this electronic health record system. So we're kind of the guinea pigs for you guys because we're implementing it first. And then, as I noted, they also operate the National Capital Area facilities, and that's actually very new. It's only been in the past 2 to 3 years that that has happened. Those used to be service-operated facilities. And in the DOD speak, we like to call these PURPLE now. So PURPLE sort of stands for tri-service, so the tri-service PURPLE facilities in the National Capital Region. Now, for the services, they fund and operate the military health, the military treatment facilities within their service, as I noted. They also provide the military labor for the MHS facilities. So there's civilian labor, and that's something that's sort of paid for by the service and through that O&M money that I mentioned that Health Affairs gives to the military treatment facilities. But the Health Affairs doesn't actually provide the military labor. That comes from the service. They're responsible for medical readiness of the force, including the medical staff, as I noted, and they also provide input into the tri-service policies. All of this is changing. In the National Defense Authorization Act of 2017, major changes were made to the military health system, and one of the biggest changes they've made, and this is, you know, highly controversial, it's something that, you know, has gone back and forth over the years. But one of the changes they've made is that all of the facilities will be operated by the Defense Health Agency. So if you go back to this slide right here and you see this Army Surgeon General, Navy Surgeon General, Air Force Surgeon General, they're going to still exist, but their role is going to be drastically different because the day-to-day management of the hospitals is about to change. And so there are tons of work groups right now working on how that is going to happen, you know, how to comply with that. And so anyway, stay tuned because that will change things a lot. The services will still be responsible for readiness within their service, though, and for advising what we call the line, which the line means the non-medical DOD people, so the tankers and the, you know, captains of the ships and things like that. Okay, so that's kind of some background about the organizational structure and who does what within the military healthcare system. And what I want to talk about next, I want to go into who are the patients. So when we talk about eligible beneficiaries, remember there are about 9.5 million eligible. And the first thing always to talk about are the active duty service members. We call those ADSMs. So there's, you know, acronyms that get thrown about a lot, the active duty service members. They gain eligibility for the MHS the day they sign on to active duty. So once their active duty status is effective, they are automatically put into a system called DEERS. That's the Defense Eligibility and Enrollment Reporting System. I'm not as familiar with the VA, but they sort of sound like they might be similar to your VBA, where they're looking at the benefits that people get. DEERS doesn't just look at healthcare benefits. There are other benefits DOD people get, like commissaries and things like that. But health benefits are one of the most important things. And so the service will actually automatically tell DEERS, hey, this is a new person. You know, this is their gender, their age, their marital status. This is their occupation. You know, all that kind of information is sent to DEERS from the service. And then the active duty service members, once they're in DEERS, they can go enroll their family members. So this is going to include what we all think of as, you know, regular family members like spouses and children, foster children. It also includes wards. It includes dependent parents, things like that. So the active duty service members enroll them, and this is a very fail-safe process. When you enroll somebody, you can't just say, hey, I had a kid. You actually have to provide a birth certificate. When you get married, you have to provide a marriage certificate, et cetera. So, you know, the relationship data that is in DEERS is quite good. The active duty service members and the active duty family members have the best access to care. So the whole point of the military health system is to make sure these people are taken care of. It's not the whole point, but the most important point. And so when they present at an MTF, they're always going to have the highest priority. And another thing that Congress did with the active duty service members and the active duty family members is that they generally don't have co-pays when they receive care in the private sector. That's actually unheard of in a lot of systems. If you look at regular private sector care, you know, for example, if I go to an emergency room, I have a very significant copay. We have military beneficiaries, active duty, and their family members could go to an emergency room, and it won't cost them a penny, completely free for them to have a regular office visit or something like that. Now, they do have some cost sharing depending on what programs they're in, but by and large, healthcare is free or close to free for this cohort. I put a couple of pictures together for you on this slide. So the blue bars on the chart are the active duty. That's what the ACT stands for. And the orange bars are the dependents of active duty. And so you can see by far Army has the most active duty, followed by, you know, Navy and Air Force are very close, and then the Marines. The Marines, remember that the Navy system is also responsible for the Marines, though, so when you add the Navy and the Marines together, they're as big as the Army. The other thing I think is interesting in this chart, and you can sort of think about real life, and if you look at the ratio of family members to active duty, it's appreciably different between, say, the Army and the Marines, where the Marines, you actually have more active duty than you have family members. And with the Army, it's not like that at all. So very different family construction across the services. Okay, the next we have the National Guard and the Reserve component. And this is an area where we have very significant overlap between the usage of the military health system and the usage of the VA. National Guard and Reserve gain eligibility for the MHS when they are called up for a period of 30 days or more. So when a Guard or Reserve is doing what some people would call weekend warrior drilling and things like that, those people aren't going to have eligibility generally. They're going to be relying on their private sector insurance or, in some cases, the VA for getting care. There's a 30-day pre-activation eligibility period, and then when they go off active duty, they have 6 full months of what they call transitional assistance. So for every activation, you add 7 months of eligibility to it that the military health system will provide. The National Guard and Reserve, when they're not on active duty and not inside this transitional or early activation period, we lose complete visibility of them in the military health system. You know that they're out there, but they're using private sector insurance, and you're not able to see it. And this is you know, we've seen this a lot when we've done studies with the DOD. I remember doing a fulfillment study. It was actually the Da Vinci proof of concept study, where we were looking at people who were screening positive for needing mental health treatment, and we were trying to follow them to see if they had the mental health treatment. And our numbers looked very good when we were just looking at active duty. But when we started looking at the Guard and Reserve, we found that it was not that common that they got their follow-on care within the military health system. In fact, it was more likely or just as likely that they would get it in the VA. So including that VA data was really important. But we also knew that wasn't giving us a complete answer, because the Guard and Reserve could also have gotten their treatment in the private sector, because they tend to have other health insurance. Anyway, when the Guard and Reserve are off active duty and outside of this period, we have a few programs that they can use to purchase eligibility. And so TRICARE Reserve Select and TRICARE Retiree Reserve Select are two such programs where people who would not normally be eligible for care can pay a premium and then can get access to care in the military health care system. The Guard and Reserve also have family members that get to enroll, so it's not just the member themselves, but like with many other plans, family members can enroll. And one thing about the National Guard and Reserve, when they are on active duty, them and their family will have the same top priority for access to care. They're legally the same benefit while they're in their active duty status. Here's just a look. This slide will tell you, you can look at active National Guard and Reserve, you can look at the family of active National Guard and Reserve, and then these categories 3 and 4, these inactive people, these are the ones that have either bought eligibility through those fee programs I mentioned, or they're in their 30 days or their 6 months windows outside of their period of activation. And one of the things about the Guard and Reserve that's important too, about 85% of them live outside of the area, what we call MTF catchment areas. So they don't live near military hospitals necessarily, which means they end up being heavy users of private sector care rather than the military hospitals. Okay, I mentioned that they don't have, so while not on active duty, the Guard and Reserve are not generally eligible for treatment. But one of the things that trips people up, I've worked with the privacy office for, you know, many, many years working on IRBs, and we've seen many a study design that doesn't recognize that it's very common for a National Guard member to be married to an active duty service member. What happens frequently is you have two active duty service members who fall in love and get married, and then they decide one of them will go ahead and just go Guard and Reserve. And so those people are particularly interesting because they can show up while they're on active duty. They show up in the system as an activated Guard and Reserve. But when they're not on active duty, they still have a benefit because they're married to someone who is. And so then they show up as a dependent of active duty. So the categories are a little bit fluid. It's not like once you're in a category, you're always in a category. Some of these people switch, you know, from retirees to dependent retirees to active duty to guard to family members, et cetera. And so it's always important when you're looking at the DOD data to recognize that. And for me, I don't use these categorical variables as much as others. I prefer to develop cohort lists and then feed cohort lists so that regardless of the status of the beneficiary, I can retrieve all of their healthcare records. I don't want to miss any. Another thing about the Guard and Reserve that's worth mentioning is that it fluctuates a lot. really depending on the operational tempo of the wars, and especially lately. You can see the surge very, or actually you can see the start of the Iraq war very well in this slide that I, or this picture that I'm showing you here. If you look at the orange bar, so that's the third line from the bottom, the orange one, see that big jump there between October and June. And what that jump is March 2003, and that was when we went to the Iraq war, and all of those Guard and Reserve members got called up, and so did all of their family. So you can imagine that puts a lot of stress on the system, because all of a sudden you have more people in that highest priority for care, and what that's going to do is push out people who weren't as high a priority, who may have been receiving care, but when you have a fixed facility with fixed providers, that's the way things go. So it's very interesting handling the National Guard and Reserve components. Okay, retirees, retiree family members, and survivors are the next category, and retirees obviously are one of the categories where we have the most overlap between the DoD and the VA. Most active duty service members separate from the service and don't have a retirement benefit. So that's the majority of people. And when that happens, they become the VA's responsibility if they have, you know, service-related issues. And the military health system doesn't really see them anymore. But there are service members who are lifers. And so when you serve more than 20 years, in the military, you become eligible for retirement benefits, and one of the retirement benefits today is access to care for the MHS. Retirees, now one thing about retirees, even if they do have access to care, they have a lower priority to receive services, and so depending on where a person lives, they may or may not be treated. I remember one time one of the health clinics around me, they just got too busy because there were so many people being activated that they had to basically tell the retirees, you're going to need to go to the private sector for a while. But that was really what the mission required, and I'll show you some slides on that in a minute, too. Another thing about the retiree population, when you study the retiree population, they're going to be a little more iffy in terms of completeness of data. First of all, they're heavy users of purchase care because they have a harder time getting access to the military hospitals, but also because they're more likely to have other coverage. Many of them are dual eligible for the VA. When the military people turn 65, they become eligible for Medicare, and they're heavy Medicare users. And also, one thing about retirement for the military, just think about this. If you join the military when you're 18, and you serve 20 years, at the age of 38, they could call you a retiree. And so most people at the age of 38 aren't going to really retire. What they're going to do is go get another job. And when they go get another job, their other job has other health insurance, especially today. And so when they have the other health insurance, the way that TRICARE and the other health insurance interact can cause problems with the availability of data. So I'll show you that in a minute, too. And if you look at the retiree population, it's a fairly large population. Of the 9.4 million people, about 5.4 of them are retired. So this is a big cohort for the military health system. Here's a population trend just by the beneficiary category. So I've got the active duty there in yellow, and you know, you can see that Iraq blip on this chart as well. What you can also see with the active duty is that we're in a period of downsizing right now. So the trend in active duty is decreasing, and that's because a lot of the Guard and Reserve are not called up right now, as our footprint in the Middle East is much smaller. And it's also because there's some downsizing being done. So there was some, growth in the force because of the wars, and that downsizing is occurring. And you can see that both in the active duty service member line and in the active duty family member line. And then the other two categories are retirees and their family members. And, of course, as they age, they're growing. Okay, so dual eligibility. I mentioned earlier there's many patients who have more than one reason for access to care. So we talked about the Guard and Reserve, where a Guard and Reserve person was married to an active duty person. But an active duty people can be married to one another. Active duty people can be married and one of them retires. We talked about the Guard and Reserve. So all of this kind of complicates things. It complicates priorities for care from an operational perspective, but it also complicates things from the use of data perspective. For example, if you wanted to look at a sponsor social security number, a sponsor social security number can change. You know, if you're the active duty service members who are married, you're both going to be your own sponsor. But the day one of them retires, the active duty person who's still on active duty could be the sponsor. And that can be represented in data systems in a number of ways. So one individual may have a number of ways to be identified in a system. We have ways to work around that, and when I give the next webinar on the data, I will talk about that. But you can't always just slam dunk use data elements that sort of seem like they might work because of some of these complex relationships. Another thing that's interesting is, you know, when you have the triple eligible population, those who have MHS, those who have VA, and those who have Medicare, those patients all will switch back and forth between the systems. So you might identify somebody as having diabetes in your data, but they're getting their HbA1c test through a military health system, and so, you know, you might have a bad HEDIS score or something like that, but it's not always representative of what is happening. This is really the point of the Da Vinci Project, making sure that you can have all of the DoD data that you need and all of the VA data that you can need and put it together in one place. Having Medicare data there would be nirvana. I know in my job, we get, in the DoD, we get, have access to some of the VA data. We also have access to the Medicare data, and we have access to the data within the MHS. And putting those three together can paint an appreciably different definition for the retiree cohort, depending on which system's data you're able to include in your reports. Okay. So what is the direct care system? Well, the direct care system is acute care hospitals, clinics, and dental facilities operated by the DoD. The direct care system does not include what we call theater information, and theater information would be care delivered in, you know, Iraq or Afghanistan or on a Navy ship. That's not part of direct care. We actually do have data on that, but it's not direct care data. Facilities are spread throughout the world, as I noted earlier, and some of the facilities are much larger than need to be. And the reason for that is we have to have a larger footprint in case we need space for war. So what the MHS has is a lot of very, very large hospitals with unused capacity. This is really very ripe for DOD-VA sharing. I do a lot of work with DOD-VA sharing, and I know that the VA has problems with access to care where veterans really need to get access. And, you know, we see articles in the paper and things like that. So that's on the VA side been a problem. On the DOD side, most of their patients are very, very young and healthy, and the providers need more practice with patients who aren't as healthy. And so they have a need for VA patients. And so this unused capacity is something that both organizations want to capitalize on to help solve problems on both sides. Most of the hospitals are small hospitals. There's only 6 hospitals with 100 or more patients in their census. And OB is by far the most popular product line. There's about 15 facilities with graduate medical education. Clinics vary drastically. Some of the clinics serve only active duty for primary care, and we have other clinics that are full service, including same-day surgeries and the likes. The MHS, like the VA, has an active patient-centered medical home program called PCMH. There's no cost sharing in the direct care, so people, they can pay for food, but otherwise they don't have to pay for anything. And this can be particularly useful when you want to study the impacts of cost sharing on access to care. And then as I've continued to note, there's an established priority for care, and I'll get to that in just a second. One other thing, the direct care system also treats patients who aren't traditionally eligible. Civilian emergencies can't be turned away. Occupational health is provided to civilian employees on the base. Overseas, the DOD civilians are being treated as must-sees. Many MTFs have VA and DOD resource sharing programs where the VA is able to refer patients over to the MTF, even if they're not eligible for care. And if you've ever been in San Antonio, the San Antonio Military Health System operates the Shock Trauma Center for the city of San Antonio. So, you know, a non-eligible, say a gang member or something, gets shot under I-35, the ambulance is going to take them to a military hospital to get treated. There's also several military treatment facilities that are co-located with the VA. There's Nellis Air Force Base in Las Vegas. There's William Beaumont Army Medical Center in El Paso, and there's Tripler Army Medical Center in Honolulu. These are literally the same buildings. Part of the building is the VA, and part of the building is the DOD, and they swap resources, and they refer to one another, et cetera. There's also the Lovell Federal Health Clinic, which is very exciting. It's the only facility like this in the world. It's in North Chicago, and it's jointly operated by DOD and VA. It causes all sorts of issues because part of the facility uses the ALTA system, that is the DOD EHR, and part of the facility uses VISTA. And so we're always having to put together the ALTA and the VISTA data in order to come up with meaningful information about what is happening there. Here are the top DRGs and MTFs. I just wanted to give you an idea of who they treat. And so I can say, you know, mom, baby, 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 mom. You know, it's moms and babies. I like to refer to it as a baby-making factory. Almost half of the admissions to military health systems are obstetrics-related. Here's encounters by clinic code. We call these MEPRS codes, but they're like your clinic stop codes. So a lot of family practice, PT, mental health, OBGYN. Now, TRICARE programs, the most basic access to the MHS is through the direct care, but there are very few beneficiaries who only have direct care. Most people have purchased care as well. The first purchased care program was called CHAMPUS. I think it came about somewhere in the 80s. It was traditional indemnity insurance, premium-free to all beneficiaries who haven't aged into Medicare. And as I said, it was initially a small portion of care for eligibles, but it's grown rapidly. In the 90s, TRICARE replaced CHAMPUS, and this was a triple option program. TRICARE Prime is a health maintenance organization. TRICARE Standard is what was called CHAMPUS, and TRICARE Extra is a preferred provider network. These programs serve the same populations as CHAMPUS did, but they offer new options in an attempt to control costs. Formerly, CHAMPUS-eligible patients got to choose to either enroll in the HMO or they get defaulted into Standard and Extra. About 4.5 million people choose to enroll in the HMO. It's one of the largest HMOs in the country. TRICARE Standard on January 1st of this year, so 10 days ago, was replaced with a program called TRICARE Select. It's basically the same program, but there's a few differences in the way cost sharing occurs. And one of the huge fundamental paradigm shifts is that it's no longer free. It's free right now for people who are in the system, but any new accession will be required to pay premiums when they retire. And the department has the authority, I think, in 2021 to start charging premiums for all non-active duty family. That's not a slam dunk that that's going to happen, but there's some language in the law that says that may happen. New accessions who do not get or maintain their premiums for TRICARE Select or another program will revert to direct care only. So this is kind of a big deal that's not happened in the past. The HMO is called TRICARE Prime. Again, you couldn't have aged into Medicare, and you have to live in what is called a prime service area or waive drive time requirements to enroll. TRICARE Prime is free for active duty and their families. There are premiums for others. They're very modest, under $300 per individual, $600 per family per year. And if you enroll in TRICARE Prime, you are required to have a referral for specialty care. Some additional benefits of Prime, you get a primary care manager. You have a legal guarantee, I've quoted the CFR here, that provides that legal guarantee of access to care within the access standards. And if it's not able to be provided, then the beneficiary is legally entitled to a referral in the network. And I've provided information about what those standards are. Prime enrollees enjoy the highest priority access at MTFs. They get better preventive and vision care benefits, and the claims are going to always be filed by the provider, so they won't have the out-of-pocket costs up front. When you look at TRICARE Prime and who enrolls in it, the first two rows represent active duty and their family, and you can see 80% of that cohort enrolls in Prime. Guard and Reserve, it's a much smaller number because not all of them live near military hospitals. The inactive Guard and Reserve, you can see almost nobody is in Prime because they're not generally eligible to enroll in Prime. You can see it's a low number for retirees, family members, and survivors as well. Okay. Medicare-eligible populations are the lowest priority for care in the direct care system. There are 2.2 million of them, and the reason for this is that there's this beautiful program called TRICARE for Life. I remember Consumer Reports said it was the best Medicare wraparound in the world, or in the U.S. Basically, under this program, if a MHS beneficiary buys Medicare Part B, then the military will pay all of their cost-sharing for Medicare. So whatever out-of-pocket costs a beneficiary has for Medicare, Medicare will just forward the claim to TRICARE and TRICARE will pay it. That means that health care is virtually free for military retirees once they age into Medicare. Now, one thing that's super important, though, is that Medicare does not provide claims to TRICARE if there's no cost sharing for Medicare. So it's a tremendous source of censoring of data because we miss the records and we miss that the care was provided. We talked a little bit about the Guard Reserve programs, and I won't say too much more, but I do want to show you the slide with the trend. You can see that little blue line up until 07 wasn't growing very fast, and after 07 it started growing very fast, and that is because the military changed the benefit and made it sweeter for the beneficiaries. TRICARE Plus is an interesting program. This is not really real coverage. The ACA would not view it as coverage, but what TRICARE Plus does, it's a free program that allows people to sign up for preferred access to primary care. It's not really how it's used, though. How it's used is that the military treatment facilities wanted their providers to have more complex patients, and so they go out and try to get Medicare eligibles to enroll in this TRICARE Plus, and then they're able to provide both primary and specialty care to them to practice their skills. There's about 200,000 TRICARE Plus patients, and TRICARE Plus has no impact on private sector care. Here's the priority for appointing. So the active duty and, you know, the reserve are going to get the highest priority. Prime enrollees are second highest, and active duty family member prime are going to be higher than retiree prime, and so on and so on. And so basically when you get down to categories 4 and 5, those people aren't always going to be able to get in. Okay, so that's important. TRICARE regional offices. TRICARE has managed care support contracts. I think VA has something similar you guys are coming out with to administer your new TRICARE or new VA choice program. So there are regional offices. These managed care support contracts are billion-dollar contracts. They include fiscal intermediary services, provider networks, referrals, enrollment management, case management, disease management, just all kinds of services. There's not any contract support for TRICARE for Life because Medicare is the primary person, but for the other programs, these MCSCs are very important. So let me just talk briefly about implications for research data, and then I'll be done. TRICARE is not one size fits all, and I hope that you have gotten that from this lecture. One of the things I was hoping to avoid is that I remember, and it was just maybe 5 years ago, DOD hired one of the most prestigious researchers out there. You'd know his name if I said it. I'm not going to. But this researcher used the data, and I thought the statistical methods were great. The cohort development was great. It was just really quality work, except that a lack of understanding of the data caused a few very significant mistakes. And when that work actually got briefed, you know, we understood those mistakes and said, whoa, this is not useful. It's not right. And so, you know, understanding some of these subtleties about the benefit is very important to using the data properly. So when patients use the direct care system, all of that detailed electronic medical record data is available. You're going to have clinical data like what are lab results. You're going to have text notes like what are the doctor's subjective and objective notes that they write. You're going to have tri-service workflow form data. So there's a lot of formatted entries that go into the EMR, that, you know, things like vital signs that are very easy to take from the form data and pull. You're going to have linkages between events and ancillaries, so you can look at doctors' ordering patterns. Like, you know, when a doctor is presented with this diagnosis, do they order an MRI, or what kind of drugs do they give people, et cetera. All that's there when people use the direct care system. Now, there's some limitations to it, and we can talk about that next month, but in general, that type of data is available. But when the patients use private sector care, and remember, that's the majority of the care, all you're going to get is what you can glean from claims. And, you know, that's not nothing. You get diagnosis and procedure codes and dates of care and, you know, whether someone died and, you know, how they came to the hospital and all that kind of stuff is available. But that clinical data that you really want to do some of the research studies that you want is just not going to be there. And there are very few patients with no private sector care. Even the active duty use private sector care. So you are always, when you do a study, having to understand, you know, who are these direct care versus private sector care people, and, how can I maximize the ability to not have this data be censored? And that's one of the big questions that a researcher should always ask themselves. And when patients have other coverage, there might not even be claims. And again, if you just use the data and take it at face value without understanding, you know, what the impacts might be of some of these things, data can be misinterpreted. I'll give you one example here as my last slide, and then I'll stop talking. Flu shots. You know, we have active flu shot programs where people are out there looking for people who need flu shots. You can go out and find them and send them reminders and try to get them to get flu shots. And I got a call many years ago from the people who ran that system, and they were very upset because they said, no one's getting flu shots anymore. What's going on? And so I started to look at the data, and I started to break it down by age group. And one of the things I found is that when I looked at senior citizens, people over the age of 65, they had the lowest rate of flu shots. And that is not what you expect, right? You expect, you know, babies and children to get them. You expect the elderly to get them. And, you know, people who have compromised systems and things like that are going to get them. But you certainly, 65 and older, should have a high percentage of flu shots. So when you look at the data that the military health system has direct access to, only 21 of every 100 eligible seniors gets a flu shot, so a 21% rate. Now, that's fairly dismal compared to what it had been in the past. Well, what happened? The ACA is what happened. Medicare changed their benefits, and preventive services, I think this was the ACA, it may have been predated it, but preventive services became essentially free for Medicare patients. So any of these DOD patients could walk in any pharmacy that accepted Medicare anywhere in the United States and get their flu shot. Medicare would, a claim would be filed, Medicare would pay the entire thing, and therefore DOD would never see it. And so these patients that we thought needed flu shots got the flu shots, it's just that DOD didn't see it. And so even if you do everything right and you crunch the numbers perfectly correctly, you know, if you don't understand how this censoring works, an inappropriate conclusion could be drawn. You could say, oh, my gosh, no one's getting flu shots, and that's simply not correct. So, you know, one of the reasons I really wanted to talk to you about these benefits was that so you understood these things and didn't fall into some of the traps of misinterpreting data because the benefit is somewhat complex. Those are the end of my prepared remarks. On my last slide is my contact information, my email address, and my phone number. And at this point, I'll turn it over to Rob so that he can continue on. Thank you for your attention.
Thanks, Wendy. You have a couple of questions.
Okay.
I know that you said that we could go a little bit late if we need to, so I will say to the audience members, if we go a little bit late, please, and you need to leave, please just answer the few questions that come up in the survey when you close out. So the first question, Wendy, around slide number 15, this person asks, please explain other. I may have missed that.
Okay. So, yes, great. Great question. Thank you. The other are the NOAA. the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the Public Health Service, and the Coast Guard.
Excellent. Thank you. Also, same questioner, right around the same time, asks, how are two married and retired military people, how does that information shake out in this regard?
Yeah, so in the DEERS data file that we get, that is the eligibility files that the military health system gets, they'll actually have two records. So we'll be able to see a record that represents each of the benefits that the person has. And then really it all comes down to their ID card. So in, you know how in the VA you guys get a PIV card. In the DOD they have a military ID card, and that military ID card is going to show what benefit they have. They show up with that military ID card, and then the military hospital or the payer will do what they call a DEERS check. And in that DEERS check is going to return back both of the benefits. And since the military health system is talking to the beneficiary while they're doing the DEERS check, they can actually see if one benefit is more appropriate than another to use for that encounter. For example, if they're an active duty family member, but they used to be a service member and they have a line of duty issue, they may show up as somebody with a line of duty issue rather than as an active duty family member. So it's really, it's what's on their ID card, and then it's how the person making the appointment choose to interpret the benefit for that particular encounter. So that's why you can have more than one benefit for a person, you know, in a short period of time.
Okay. Hopefully that answers this question. You got quite a few wonderful, thank you for the presentations, but the next question, can you explain in more detail what DaVinci is / will be? What data will be available? When will it be available? Who will be able to use it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So DaVinci is a joint DOD and VA project, and so for the project, clinical domains of interest were selected, so things like laboratory results or, you know, surgical procedures or something like that. And then based on those clinical domains, data is being pushed into the DaVinci project from the Vinci system. So, you know, things like lab results, radiology, pharmacy, inpatient admissions, visits, things like that are going to be in DaVinci from the VA side. And then from the DOD side, they're feeding in the same types of data there. And then because both systems are different, we capture data differently, we use different sets of valid values and things like that, there's a very significant mapping process going on. So between DOD and VA, and VA has a lot of help from a gentleman, Dr. Mike Matheny, who's very wonderful that we work with, and his team out at Vanderbilt, and all of us together meet routinely to talk about how to consistently map data so that as a researcher, you aren't going to have to know, well, this is the way DOD does stuff, this is the way VA does stuff, now let me mash it together. The DaVinci project is going to do that mashing together for you. In terms of access to care, I think the access portals are different depending on whether somebody is DOD or VA. I think it's being organized so that DOD and VA both have the ability to sign people onto the systems for that. And as far as when it's going to be available, that is a really good question. I want to use the word soon. I'm not the person actually responsible for those timelines and haven't seen a final date on that, so I don't want to give you that answer other than to tell you we're working very hard. We do have the data combined, or together, the data's there. It's just a matter of getting these mappings and getting everything through quality assurance and making sure it's right before we can get it out there. So I'm sorry that I'm not giving you the answer that you want, but I essentially don't have the answer. So I just sort of gave you the best I could. Hope that was helpful.
Wendy, perhaps if that person asking that question of when tunes in to the follow-up next month, you might have more information at that point.
Yeah, I'll try to get some information for that. I don't want to speak officially without talking to my project officer either. It's important to make sure I don't get out ahead of anyone, you know what I mean? So.
Sure. Okay, next question. How do you ascertain mortality among users of the system, whether using military, hospital, or outside care?
Okay, so a couple of ways that we look at mortality. First of all, the DOD, the Pentagon, provides us a file from an organization called Casualty Affairs. And Casualty Affairs keeps track of every active duty, guard, or reserve death. So we have very good death data for active duty, guard, and reserve. For family members, we have a couple of ways we do this. One way is that we can glean mortality from healthcare records, either direct care or purchase care. If somebody dies in an emergency room or dies in a military hospital, or a civilian hospital for that matter, or even in an office, the records are going to be marked with a disposition status of death. Sometimes people get marked with a disposition status of death and they haven't died. I'll get into that in a minute. One other source comes from DEERS. And so DEERS has two ways they learn of deaths. They have family members can report deaths. The service can report deaths to them. So those two ways. And then they also get a regular feed from the Social Security Administration, which provides death information to them. So between all of those sources, we have in our corporate data warehouse, we have a processor that pulls together all of those data sources. And one other check we actually do, because we've seen deaths miscoded in the data, we go through the healthcare system and we try to see if we have any evidence of the person we thought was dead going to receive care. And if we do, then we can mark that too. And so in this death file, it has the, you know, name and SSN and, you know, DEERS ID of the person who was deceased, but it also has the date. It has the cause of death if it came from Casualty Affairs, and then it has flag values to tell you where this death information was reported so that if you thought that one source wasn't as reliable as another, you could exclude it if you wanted to or include it if you didn't.
Great. Thank you. The questions keep flooding in.
That's fine. That's what I'm here for.
Does the MHS require mandatory reporting of ICD E codes? Does the
yes.
MHS reimburse E codes?
Yes and yes. I'm assuming you're meaning E as in ICD-9. The E in ICD-10 is diabetes, but you're thinking injury codes, right? I think.
Well, I invite that person to, yes, this person says yes.
Yeah, we do record them. We've actually had a little bit of a problem, and I don't know if you guys have as well, since the implementation of ICD-10, though. Under ICD-9, the injury codes were all starting with E, and they were all in the same place and very easy to find. Under ICD-10, they've been removed from the E's. The E's are mostly diabetes, and the injury codes occur sort of sporadically throughout the ICD-10 nomenclature, and it's a lot harder for a provider to find those codes than it used to be, and I've seen a decrease in injuries reported since ICD-10, and I can't tell you for sure whether that's actually a decrease or it's just that it's harder to code. So that's, you know, that's the injury data.
Great, thank you. I do apologize for the echo if other people are hearing it. Next question. What data are available for TRICARE, MCSD, and FIA managed care? Are diagnosis and treatment data from the HMO type contracts available in MHS data?
Yes, they are. So if you think about a typical TRICARE claim, or in a typical claim, a private sector claim, everything that would be on a Medicare claim comes in to the DOD for services provided under TRICARE. So we have, I want to say maybe each claim has, depends on the type of claim, but you can have somewhere in the order of 12 or 13 different diagnosis codes and 12 or 13 different procedure codes for each claim. So yeah, we do get those codes, which are really helpful because you can identify cohorts and you can do things like HEDIS and you can run the AHRQ software and stuff like that. I think the data that, because the purchase care data is such a big proportion of care for the DOD, it's not like the fee care for VA. It's like the majority of the care. We have to pay particular attention to be able to understand what's happening. And so that claims data is definitely quite detailed. It's just we don't have lab results. You know, we don't have doctor's notes. We don't have, you know, radiology reports or vital signs or things like that.
Bernie, this next one harkens back to the questions around slide number 15, and it is, does other include merchant marines?
No.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. How will non-VA / non-DOD, a.k.a. civilian, researchers be able to access the master data set?
That's a good question. I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that question. I'd be speculating if I answered. Maybe I can take a note and try to answer it when I come back next month. Sorry about that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
This next one asks if you would please mention the use of OMOP as the common data model to map the two.
Absolutely. Yeah, so when I talked about DaVinci, one of the things I talked about is that the DOD and the VA data were getting modeled so that they would be coded the same way, so that you wouldn't have to be an expert in DOD data and in VA data in order to analyze the data. You could just go in and it would be one coding schema. And so what the DOD and the VA have selected as that model is the OMOP. Oh, gosh, I can't remember the outcome. It's something about medical, or the acronym, it's something about medical outcomes partnership, observational medical outcomes partnership, something like that, that the OMOP model is what has been selected. And so all of the work being done jointly between DOD and VA on combining the two systems is the OMOP model itself. Thank you. I'm not sure who asked that, but that was a good thing to point out.
I think it was a very intelligent person that asked that question.
Maybe it was my project officer. I don't know.
Next one. Great presentation, Wendy. Given that DaVinci is getting servicemen and women, what are the options for VA investigators to request research projects wanting to look at dependent data?
Oh, so you mean the family members that aren't generally going to be in the DaVinci. So if you want to look at family members, DOD is a little bit different than VA. The VA has a research mandate. The DOD does not, but that does not mean they don't do research. They do a lot of research. And so there are RFPs, if that makes, you know, requests for proposal that come out routinely from the DOD for people who want to do research studies or who want research studies done for them. And if people respond to those RFPs, they can do work with the DOD. DOD is not very flexible. Like Medicare, you know how you can just go to Medicare, or maybe you can go to Medicare, and if you're willing to pay for the data, you can get the data and you can do what you want with it. You still have to do DUAs and things like that, but DOD is not like Medicare. There has to be a DOD sponsor on a project to be using these data. And so, you know, either responding to an RFP or, you know, collaborating heavily with someone within the DOD is probably the best way to get access to that dependent data. I've seen a lot of people coming through the VA who do get access to these kinds of data, but and under the auspices of DaVinci, let me say this recently, under the auspices of DaVinci, sometimes people come in through the VA over to DOD and get sponsorship, but since the dependents are generally out of scope of DaVinci, that might not work. You might have to just, you know, collaborate with someone within DOD. wish I had a better answer for you. I know a lot of people would like to have more easy access to the data. But the DoD data, you have to think about, I think sometimes people don't think about this, but it is a little more sensitive than any other healthcare data. So it's healthcare data, but it's healthcare data for our active duty service members. And so when you think about that, you know, patterns of illness and injury and places where things occur, those can be pretty sensitive pieces of information that you wouldn't want to get into the hands of people who don't have the best interests of the U.S. in mind. So there are going to be a little more particular about what data gets released and readily used than some of the other organizations might be for that reason.
Thank you. Wendy, I just thought maybe you should advance your slides again to your last one so that your contact information is up.
Sure.
There okay, last two. The VA links to the Social Security Death Index. Will that be possible to do with this data once available to VA researchers?
It probably depends on how you guys have your arrangement with the Death Index people. I know when I get data from the Death Index people, I have ways I'm allowed to use it and ways I'm not allowed to use it. And so there's probably some sort of agreement that the VA has with the National Death Index folks. And I would think that you would have to look at what that agreement says.
Okay, and this one will wrap it up. Will metadata from DaVinci be available via data.gov for researchers in a non-personally identifiable data process, basically general population health data?
I don't know the answer to that question. I'm sorry.
Okay.
It sounds like a DaVinci briefing might be in order at you know, for this cyber seminar series at some point. Maybe it's occurred. I'm not sure. But maybe it, you know, that kind of information would be good for something like that. I'm sorry.
For a future.
Yeah.
For a future cyber seminar?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Great.
Especially as DaVinci gets further along and gets close to being implemented, it'd be awesome to come back and say, hey, look what we've got. So,
well, based on all the questions that you got, I think that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
Well, that about does it for questions. If you have any closing comments, now would be the time, or we can just go ahead and close.
No, I'd just like to thank everybody for your attention. I appreciate your time and your listening to me. And you know, feel free to reach out to me if you have any questions, and I'll be back next month. And next month I'll be talking about data elements and data files and particular strengths and weaknesses of them. So if you found today's presentation compelling, I hope to talk to you next month in a little bit more detail. And so thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for preparing and presenting today. Audience members, the next Vinci session will be February 8th, it's always or as often as possible, the second Thursday of the month from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Time. See you then. Thanks again, Wendy.
Yep, you're welcome. Bye, Rob.
Bye.